London dropped its dignity.
Yeah.
So has France and Germany.
Yeah.
All hands are dancing to a raggedy melody full of originality.
Sing it, though.
Hello and welcome to Yesterday's Chip Paper, the fortnightly-ish podcast where we look at strange and bizarre and macabre stories from historic newspaper archives. My name is Violet.
And I'm Jim, and we're two amateur researchers who like old newspapers. And every couple of weeks we will get together and just talk about one, a story that we found as told in the old newspapers. But this week... it's a bit different.
Really?
Yes. This week, I've made our introduction a lie. because...
we're now covering sports.
So, they cover sports in newspapers.
Yeah, that's true.
That is true. So, I was going through newspapers from the early 18th century. Sort of,
as you do.
As I do. and... there were, I mean, I already knew about this thing. It was the Newgate calendar. And there were reports, as you get towards the end of the 17th and then the early, not 17th, Jesus, 18th, the 1700s. As you get to the end of the 18th and then the early 19th century, the Newgate calendar is advertised in newspapers, you know, for purchase. So I looked into whether I could find a PDF or a scanned version online, and I did find one. So Newgate Prison there's been a prison on the site of Newgate in London from the 12th century until 1902, and it's where the Old Bailey is. If you go around the side of the Old Bailey, the main courts in London, you can still see a wall from Newgate Prison.
That's cool.
I haven't seen it, but I know it's there. Newgate went through different levels of notoriety through history, but it was kind of always a boogeyman sort of thing, you know. It was like Dickens visited there quite a lot. Even though it went through different sort of phases of notoriety, it was consistently a really awful place, really. There's a really good book by a guy called Stephen Halliday, and it's called Newgate, London's Prototype of Hell.
His name is Halliday, though.
I don't know why you love that.
Because it's like holiday. And it's like a document of hell.
That's a good point.
There you go. See, I know what I'm talking about.
Tweet him. to quote the Wikipedia page for Newgate, because I want to give a bit of backstory in case people don't know what Newgate is.
Which
I'm sure.
I mean,
does,
I know very little about it.
Yeah.
I mean, aside from the fact that it was a horrendous prison.
Really, really, really terrible. So just quoting Wikipedia, prisoners who could afford to purchase alcohol from the prisoner-run drinking cellar by the main entrance to Newgate remained perpetually drunk. There were lice everywhere, and jailers left the prisoners chained to the walls to languish and starve. The legend of the black dog, an emaciated spirit thought to represent the brutal treatment of prisoners, only serves to emphasise the harsh conditions. So it's very much like your house.
Yeah, I mean, I was just chasing a mouse out of the kitchen.
Basically the same.
It's now hung up on the wall.
So
referring to the prisoners.
It's a really, really horrible place. It's a horrible place, actually, unless you were rich. In The Prototype of Hell, Halliday talks about a rich man who had a family in Newgate because his quarters was very nice and he was there for a long time. But part of what Newgate was there for was to hold condemned prisoners before they were taken to Tyburn. Tyburn, if you don't know what it is, it was a gallows, the Tyburn Tree. Tyburn was a place, and the Tyburn Tree was a gallows, a three-sided gallows, where they executed people. So people would be held at Newgate. They would be taken out, they'd be paraded down, I think, Holborn and Oxford Street, which is now the main shopping street in London, and to the Hanging Tree. And the streets would be lined with people, and depending on what the crime was, if it was a murderer, they would be cursed and they'd have things thrown at them. If they were a highwayman, they'd have songs sung for them and, attestations of love and things, because highwaymen were very popular. And quite often people would come and rescue their friends. They would storm the coach and get the guy out. So that's Newgate. It's a horrible place. And the governor at Newgate would keep and issue a record of the prisoners held there who were executed and their crimes and other punishments. And it was called the Newgate Calendar. In the late 18th and early 19th century, I mean, this was just like, this guy did this, this is his punishment.
Yeah.
In the late 18th and early 19th century, the Newgate Calendar was kind of rewritten and editorialized and moralized as well into like a chapbook and then a Penny Dreadful. And I found online a copy of the Penny Dreadful version, which I think I think was published in 1824, but there is no publishing date in the version that I've found. So this technically isn't a newspaper.
I think it qualifies close enough.
Yeah, and it's... So it's written in the early 19th century and it's about crimes that take place around 1700. So, you know...
Yeah, so surely you can use it as a bit of a guidebook into the papers and what you're actually looking for.
So what I expect, the minimum that I expect from a newspaper is fact. The minimum that I expect from the Newgate Calendar is words.
I like where you're going with this.
Like, these crimes happened. These things happened.
Yeah.
But they rubbed some sass on it.
Right.
And they finished it. It's hilarious because they finished each one with this really intense moralizing. And it's so...
So who would have been reading this when it became the Penny Dreadful? Was this available just to the public?
No, it's like, yeah.
Just like a paper would have been?
Yeah, it was advertised in the... It was more of a book. I suspect with the Penny Dreadful, it was probably serialized. I don't think they would have bought all... Because it's 428 pages long.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I think it was probably serialized, which maybe means this isn't the Penny Dreadful, who knows. So I'm going to read out just a couple of... the criminals in this, in the new, it was called the New Newgate Calendar when it was turned into a Penny Dreadful. It is available at archive.org. You can just search New Newgate Calendar and it'll come up as an archive.org link. It's brilliant. I think I've read the whole thing.
I was making a note of it, like, well, there's my reading sorted for the next couple of weeks.
Well, I've read this all in 2 days. It's not
really,
it's not like, not very
prone to read. Is it illustrated?
There are illustrations. I don't know why, though, because there's like six, I could have done without it, but whatever.
Are they like really extravagant, like the ones that you find in the illustrated London papers?
No. No, this is earlier than that, I think.
Okay.
So I'm just going to read out a couple of them. One is, I mean, both have really stupid elements. I'll dive right in. And all of this, I'm going to read, everything that I read out is in the language of the time. And I think that's why I find it so interesting, is because they're talking about crimes that were 100 years previous, but that it is written in the language of the late 18th, early 19th century, which means I'm probably going to say something's going to be like talked about as a case, and I'm probably going to call it a cafe because it'll have an F in it where it should be an S.
The murder cafe.
Sounds
like a pop-up in East London.
I wouldn't go. So, account of the singular case of John Smith, called Half-Hanged Smith, who was convicted but escaped death in a most remarkable manner. This malefactor was the son of a farmer at Malton, about 15 miles from the city of York. It's near where my mum lives, isn't it? Who bound... That wasn't
Is it the, you?
That wasn't in the original text.
Okay.
that would make this book better. Who bound him apprentice to a packer in London, with whom he served out his time and afterwards worked as a journeyman. He then went to sea in a merchantman, after which he interred on board a man of war and was at the famous expedition against Vigo. But on the return from that expedition, he was discharged. He had not long been discharged from the naval service when he enlisted as a soldier in the regiment of guards commanded by Lord Cutts. But in this station, he soon made bad connections and engaged with some of his dissolute companions as a housebreaker. On the 5th of December 1705, he was arraigned on 4 different indictments, on 2 of which he was convicted and received sentence of death. This is for theft, bear in mind. While he lay under sentence, he seemed very little affected with his situation, absolutely depending on a reprieve through the interest of his friends. However, an order came for his execution on the 24th day of the same month, in consequence of which he was carried to Tyburn, where he performed his devotions and was turned off in the usual manner. They're hanged.
Turned off.
Yeah. But when he had hung near 15 minutes, the people present cried out, "A reprieve!" Hereupon the malefactor was cut down, and being conveyed to a house in the neighbourhood, he soon recovered, in consequence of bleeding,
so
they bled him, and other proper applications. Yeah, it wasn't trapdoor like drop hanging. It was just death by.
So how did it work?
Asphyxiation. And that takes a lot longer than you think.
Yeah.
And it was a spectator sport as well. Like, there's no fun for the spectators if somebody just dies instantly. Although I think people did go in, I don't know if this happened at Tyburn, but people would go and grab their legs and pull the legs to break their neck and things. When he perfectly recovered his senses, he was asked what were his feelings at the time of execution, to which he repeatedly replied in substance as follows, that when he was turned off, he for some time was sensible of very great pain, occasioned by the weight of his body, and felt his spirits in a strange commotion, violently pressing upwards, that having forced their way to his head, he, as it were, saw a great blaze or glaring light, which seemed to go out at his eyes with a flash, and then he lost all sense of pain. That after he was cut down and began to come to himself, the blood and spirits forcing themselves into their former channels put him, by a sort of pricking or shooting, to such intolerable pain that he could have wished those hanged who had cut him down. So he had like the worst pins and needles that anyone's ever had. So yeah, after this narrow escape from the grave, this is just stupid. After his narrow escape from the grave, Smith pleaded to his pardon on the 20th of February, yet such was his propensity to evil deeds that he returned to his former practices, and being again apprehended, he was tried at the Old Bailey for housebreaking. But some difficulties arising in the case, the jury brought in a special verdict, in consequence of which the affair was left to the opinion of the 12 judges, who determined in favour of the prisoner. So he got off again.
Why?
I don't know. because everything in 1705 was just sure. Like they were just making it up.
They were just like, what, draw another straw, you're free.
Yeah, jury, can you decide if this man is guilty or not guilty of housebreaking? No, you do
Jesus
it.
Jesus Christ.
You do it.
Fine.
After this second extraordinary escape, he was a third time indicted, but the prosecutor happened to die before the day of...
Was it housebreaking?
No, you have to listen to this bit,
Okay.
After the second extraordinary escape, he was a third time indicted, but the prosecutor happened to die the day before of the trial. So he once more obtained that liberty which his conduct showed he had not deserved. The prosecutor died, so they just said, well, you're free to go.
That's insane.
I know.
At what point do you think a guy should be like, you know what? I don't think I'm cut out for housebreaking.
We don't know how much housebreaking he was doing. He could have broken like a million houses. And B, I'm not sure the deck was that fairly stacked against poor people in 1705.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
I mean, the outcome is literally that you're going to get executed, and they have already bungled an execution of you in the past, so you know how bad it is.
Mm.
Or maybe it's not that bad. Maybe he was like...
actually...
Yeah. We have no account what became of this man after his third remarkable incident in his favour, but Christian charity inclines us to hope that he made a proper use of the singular dispensations of Providence evidenced in his own person.
He set up a stealing school.
History scarce affords a more extraordinary case than this of Smith, but let no one who reads this account of his triple escape from the gallows indulge in a moment's inclination to the pursuit of illicit practices, since, in almost every instance but the present, the ways of vice assuredly lead to destruction, and we are not assured that they did not do in this case, for the sequel of his life has not come to our knowledge.
Oh.
It's the moralising at the end that I like, because it's like, don't do crime because you'll be executed,
but, and then get away with it.
Yeah, but not like this guy. So that's John Smith, who
that's great.
Half-hanged Smith.
What's he actually called, John Smith?
I mean, who's checking?
It doesn't really matter.
But who's checking? Like, what's your name? Johnny Big. Potatoes. Yeah, they can't check. And then the second case that I've got, this guy is ballsy. It is.
And the first guy got out of his sentence three times.
The first guy, John Smith. Listen, this is child's play. This is amateur hour compared to the ballsiness of Alexander Day. Who was convicted?
That's a great name.
Alexander Day. Yeah, they have.
I don't know why it's so great. I just heard it. I was just like, yeah, that's it.
They have.
That's the ultimate name.
At the top of each page, they have a headline of the case or a little header of the case that's being written about. and they just they abbreviate the first name. So at the top of each of the page of this case, it just says Alde. Yeah, Alde.
Do you remember back episode 15, I think it was, when you asked what I changed my name to?
Yeah.
I found it.
You're going to change Alde. Your name to Alexander Day.
Yeah.
And then your initials would be A Day.
Exactly. So great.
And you would get confused by everything. You'd be like, pick a day. And you'd be like, what?
When does anyone ever ask you to pick a day?
An apple a day. An apple.
Oh my God. A-day. I could change my name to A Day and then set up some sort of apple selling business.
Oh no. Just don't finish it.
Jesus. Sorry, I've just sorted out my life plan. Forget this podcast, Lark. Anyway, carry on.
Well, good.
Great name.
So, singular case of Alexander Day, who was convicted of defrauding several tradesmen. This is, the moralizing is really good on this one. I have abridged this article, because it was really long. But this guy, yeah, this guy's got chutzpah. In modern times, we have several instances of villains who have proceeded on a familiar plan with Day. So, to, like, sorry, hang on, let me start.
I'm already so confused. I have to start that again. What?
In modern times, we have had several instances of villains who have proceeded on a similar plan with Day. That's very... They just mean done the same thing. Nor any of them met with a fate exactly similar. We should be the more particular in our account of this artful villain. So, because this guy, like... This guy's, like, top con man idiot. So, Day was a professed sharper who pretended to be a man of fortune. He assumed the title of Marmaduke Davenport Esquire, which, because as we say, in the 18th century, you could call yourself anything. Marmaduke Davenport Esquire, and taken a large house in Queen Street, asserted that he possessed a capital estate in the north of England. He had a footman who seems to have been an accomplice with him. This man he sent to a livery stable to acquire the price of a pair of horses, which he himself agreed to purchase, and then desired the stable keeper to recommend him a coachman, a man rather lusty, which I think means fat, as he had a suit of livery clothes of a large size by him. The man was accordingly recommended, but when the livery was tried on, Day observed that, as they did not fit him, he would send into the country for his own coachman. But this objection was obviated by the footman, who, saying that the clothes would fit with a small alteration, the squire consented to hire the man. When the stable-keeper saw the coachman he had recommended, he inquired as to what places he had driven his new masters, and being informed to the Duke of Montagu's and other persons of rank, he seemed satisfied, though he had begun to form ideas unfavourable to his new customer. Mr. Day, having kept his coach and horses something more than a week, gave orders to be driven to a coffee-house in Red Lion Square, where he drank half a pint of wine at the bar and asked if some gentlemen were come whom he expected to supper. Being answered in the negative, he went out the back door without paying for his wine and said he would return in a few minutes. The coachman waited a long time, but his master not coming back, he drove to the stable-keeper, who seemed glad to have recovered his property out of such dangerous hands. So at this stage, he's used a cart and horse, whatever. I don't know if that's the correct terminology, and a coachman for a week. And not paid. Okay. And then he's...
Wait, is he... So he's masquerading as this Marmaduke character.
Marmaduke Davenport Esquire. Okay. He's basically he's pretending to be an aristocrat and saying that he's got a large estate in the north and he's down in London on, you know, gallivanting. So he's got a week's use out of two horses and a coach and a coachman. And then he's done a dine and dash to get out of it. He just ran away.
Brilliant.
It seems that Day made no small use of this coach while it was in his possession. He drove to the shop of a lace merchant named Gravestock and asked for some Spanish point, but the dealer having none of that kind by him, the squire ordered £55 worth of gold lace. The squire is Esquire, like Malmic Davenport. Ordered £55 worth of gold lace to be sent to his house in Queen Square. When Gravestock's servant carried the lace, Day desired him to tell his master to call, as he was in want of some lace for some rich liveries, but he must speak with his tailor before he could ascertain the quantity wanted. So the employee has brought some lace round and he said, yes, send your master. Mr. Gravestock attended his new customer, who gave him so large an order for lace that if he had executed it, he must have been a very considerable loser. I don't know what that means. and the squire's liveries would have been gayer than those of any nobleman in London. However, on the following day he carried some lace of the sort he had left before, nor did he forget to take his bill with him, but the person who should have paid it was decamped. So the guy brought loads of lace round, and then came back the next day, with more, and found out that Day had just run away again. He's a scamp.
Such a scamp
is Day. Then
I feel like a scamp steals an apple. I think this guy might be more
than
a scamp.
Are you setting up another apple a day joke?
No.
Because I will not stand for it.
I try to drop them in everywhere.
The next trick practiced by our adventurer was as follows. He went to the house of Mr. Markham, a goldsmith, and ordered this... I'm sure there is a word, then you will know the word when I say it. I am sure this word means something different. But I didn't check because the current meaning of it makes this very, very funny to me. The next trick practiced by our adventurer was as follows. He went to the house of Mr. Markham, a goldsmith, and ordered a gold equipage worth £50. Markham carried home the equipage, and I don't know if that's how you say it. And had the honour to drink tea with the supposed Mr. Davenport. He ordered other curious articles, and among the rest, a chain of gold for his squirrel.
I mean, you know what? He could have actually... You know how they have, like, the monkeys on the leads? I remember seeing pictures of, like, the rich people in the old days, and they had, like, their monkeys, but obviously they had leads on them, so they didn't run away. Could be a squirrel.
I can believe the guy's got a squirrel.
I can believe it. That's really great, though.
Yeah, and the squirrel has more jewellery than I have. And I am a grown adult man. Mr. Markham, observing that the squirrel wore a silver chain, so this squirrel's going to have two chains.
Weighed down.
Which he had sold to a lady not long before, began to suspect his new customer, and waiting on the lady, inquired if she knew Marmaduke Davenport, Esquire. She answered in the negative, on which Markham mentioned the circumstance that had arisen, and described the person of the defrauder. The lady now recollected him, and said that his name was Alexander Day, and that he had cheated her of property to a considerable amount. In consequence of this information, Markham arrested the sharper and recovered his property. What I like about that is that there's a goldsmith who sold a chain to a woman, and somebody's like, Alexander Day has defrauded this woman and been like, yeah. And then instead of fencing the chain or selling it or whatever, he literally gives it to a squirrel.
I really like this guy.
Yeah. He sounds fascinating.
What did he do with the lace?
So I guess sold it. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe
it's okay, Jim.
Maybe he wrapped a cow in it.
Maybe he wrapped lots of squirrels in it.
Yeah, maybe he made doilies for some stables. There's another story. I've abridged a bit in the middle there because it talks about a lot of his scams, and they're all quite funny, but quite repetitive. So there's one where this one. He goes to a silk mercer and says, hey, can you send a load of silk to my house, please? And the silk mercer says, no, that's stupid. You should come to the... I'm paraphrasing.
This is a great businessman.
Yeah, I'm paraphrasing. But the mercer says, no, you should come to the shop and see him there, which is a pretty smart thing to do. So hereupon Day took the mercer in his coach, and on their way he talked of his father, Sir Marmaduke, and of other people of rank, and said he was on the point of marriage with the daughter of Councillor Ward. And as he should be under a necessity of furnishing a house in London, he would want mercery goods to a large amount. When they came to the mercer's shop, Day selected as many damasks, etc. for bed furniture and hangings as were worth £1,000. So yeah, £1,000, that'll buy you like... Belgium? It looks as if Hinchcliffe had now some suspicion, for he told him that the ladies were best judges of such articles, and asked if he had not a lady of his acquaintance whom he could consult. He readily answered that he had.
He said, no, but I have a squirrel.
Yeah, I have a very, very feminine squirrel.
With an exquisite taste.
Yeah.
See his gold chain?
He readily answered that he had, and mentioned a Lady Davenport as his relation, saying, send the silks to my house, and I will take her opinion of them. Right. On this one he went too big. £1,000 is ridiculous.
That's a lot of silk.
Mr. Hinchcliffe said he would send them and permitted him to take with him two pieces of brocade worth about £30. But desirous to know more of his customer before he trusted him with the whole property, he went to Councillor Ward, the person who he said he was marrying the daughter of, and found that his daughter was already married to a gentleman of the name of Davenport. Hereupon, the mercer went to the house of the supposed esquire, but he was gone off with what property he had obtained. So he got £30 out of this. Which, again, that'll buy you, like, Wales.
That's a lot.
Yeah. This is just funny. This is just a really weird bit. It was likewise discovered that our adventurer, having casually met at a coffee house that Mr. Davenport, who had married the daughter of Councillor Ward, had prevailed on him to call him cousin on the pretense that they must be related because, as he alleged it, their coats of arms were the same. So it's just he just sidles up to a rich guy and is like, hey, nice coat of arms. Mine's the same. And it makes him call him cousin. That was the length of that was that con.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Good job, man.
Yeah. If that's what you're doing. So he gets caught, obviously, because he's just an outlandish scamp. So this is how it's written in the New Newgate Calendar. After a fair trial, he was convicted and sentenced to suffer 2 years imprisonment in Newgate, to stand twice in the pillory, to pay a fine of £200, a lot of twos in this, and to give security for his good behaviour for 2 years after the term of imprisonment should be expired. So, yeah, he goes for 2 years and then gets like 2 years probation. And has to pay £200. And has to stand in the... He has to stand in the pillory, though. Which is unpleasant.
So, describe for us the pillory.
So, the pillory at Newgate, the pillory is like the stocks, but slightly different. But it's a public humiliation thing. Daniel Defoe, the author of Robinson Crusoe, was put in the pillory at Newgate. And I think it involved some actual corporal punishment as well. But it was embarrassing. And I think physically very unpleasant. I'll tweet
that. But the squirrel got off.
We don't know about the squirrel. Maybe I haven't read all
of it. He's rolling around in thousands of pounds of silk.
Maybe I haven't read all of the New Newgate Calendar, and maybe page 289 or something is about a squirrel. So before I read the moralising bit of this, of which, yeah, there is some. One guy breaks into houses and is executed.
Yeah, this is what I was just thinking, but then forgot to actually verbalise.
Do you think they're just like, wow, we admire the ambition?
See, this is what I was saying before about like just pulling a straw and seeing what the sentence was.
Yeah.
It seems very kind of like there's no order or logic to it at all.
Yeah, but I think they were crimes.
Is it because he was wealthy? He wasn't wealthy.
No,
he wasn't.
I don't think he was wealthy. But I think they were crimes. I think maybe it's like forging coins was a form of treason. And if you, like, if a servant stole from her master, that was petty treason. His or her master. The only reason I said her is because I was reading a case of somebody who did that. Anyway, so the moralising bit. This fellow is one of those abandoned miscreants whom modern times have distinguished by the name of swindlers, and of all men breathing they seem to be the most destitute of principle. They literally go about seeking whom they may devour. It is astonishing that tradesmen should be so frequently duped by the artifices of these villains, which, yeah, it is, since scarce a week passes in which the newspapers do not give an account of some of the tricks by which they impose on the unwary. As it is one professed in this instance has got three F's in it. Just give me a chance to understand what you're saying. As it is one of the professed design of this publication to guard innocent people against the schemes of the artful and designing, we would earnestly recommend it to the people in trade never to give credit to strangers from the speciousness of their appearance or the plausibility of their behaviour. The villain can defraud a coachmaker out of a carriage or even raise money to hire one of an elegant appearance, has nothing to do but take genteel lodgings and put an accomplice or two into livery, and his scheme usually succeeds. The splendid appearance of the supposed master and the artful puffs of the servants generally serve to lull suspicion asleep. And if I said that sentence as it is written, I would have said, the splendid appearance of the verpoved mafter and the artful puffs of the servants generally ferved to lull suspicion afleep.
Fervent, you mean?
When inquiry is made into the character...
I think we should go back and just do that entire story again.
No, I think...
But this time with all the F's kept in.
I think that would make me very ill. When inquiry is made into the character of a person who is supposed to be a man of honour and fortune, the inquirer should consider whether that person who... the person who gives in this character is deserving of that of an honest man. For these artful rogues, when they find any person is suspicious of them, have a method of referring to as great rogues as themselves for a character. The tradesman, then, would not be imposed on, should take characters from only from respectable people who will never deceive them, unless they have been deceived themselves. The being exposed in the pillory is very inadequate to the punishment, much less to the cure of this crime. The wretches themselves are dead to all sense of shame. Few persons see their faces so perfectly as to recollect them, and when the term of their imprisonment is expired, they put on a gay suit of clothes and begin to make fresh depredations on the public. And this ends, and this is...
You know what? They're really selling it, though.
Yeah, they make...
They're like, it's rubbish, but, you know, at the other side, put on your good clothes and no one knows.
But that's it, though, isn't it? It's like, it's salacious.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
But also, in both of these instances, they kind of get away with it. You know, crime pays.
And they're basically telling people that.
Yeah.
Through that supposedly moral ending.
Yeah.
Which... Just what?
And it ends with, in the meantime, however, let it be remembered that the life of vice is a life of perpetual anxiety, and that the readiest way to be happy is to be virtuous. And that might as well be like, wink. Because we're showing you, that's not true. So yeah, those are two, just two excerpts from it. I mean, I might revisit it in the future because it's 428 pages of 200-year-old writing about 300-year-old crimes. And
I'm hearing a spin-off podcast here.
But I was so excited when I found it. I mean, yeah, and I just raced through it. It's really, really interesting. So not a newspaper, but technically paper at one stage.
I printed out this online website.
Yeah.
And it is now in print.
So that's my bit of this week's podcast. I actually, to really show the finality of that, I just took my glasses off.
with gusto.
Yeah.
And then remembered you were sitting inside a tiny closet and went, ow, God, my arm.
Oh, I am, yeah. It's very, very small. I'm lucky that I don't suffer from...
And it's warm today.
Yeah, as I have said
to you. Those are very warm.
As I've said to you, I am a warm man in a hot box.
Not that kind of hot box, though. Just to clarify...
I am so out of touch with the kids.
You must know what that is. That's an American saying as well. You should know that one.
Yeah, you know I'm not actually from here. but anyway, one of the things that we like to do as well, two of the things that we like to do, we like to find letters and poems in the newspapers. And that is, for the same reason that I really enjoy reading the Newgate calendar. It's because it puts some sort of historical context into what was important to people. And the worlds that they lived in and what was going on that wouldn't necessarily be remembered. And also real pettiness and vitriol, which I love it. And poems, because poems are just quite often quite funny. So, Violet, what have you found?
For this episode, I found a letter that appeared in the Hull Daily Mail.
A fine paper.
Very fine publication. On the 10th of May, 1918. So the very final stretch of the Great War. And this letter was surrounded by other letters written by troops on the front line writing home and people writing about the latest developments in the fighting. But this one was titled A Curious Potato.
Oh.
To the editor of the Daily Mail. Sir, this potato was found by me.
Through this. Push through it.
This potato was found by me while preparing the ration allowance for dinner. It is rather a curious shape, so I thought I would send it, as it may interest some of your readers. I receive your paper quite frequently, and when I was home on leave, I noticed several curios in the office window. I am, sir, H.T. Pearson. And the editor just left him a note. There isn't even a picture. There's no description of what it looks like.
That's really
but
shoddy.
The editor wrote, "We thank our correspondent, and we'll put the potato on view." And that is it.
But so, as far as we know, that potato could have just been curious. We have absolutely no idea what it looked like.
It actually just really wanted to learn a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
It's the most curious potato you've ever met.
Yeah. That's why they put it in the window. It just asks people questions on the way back.
Anyway.
Also, in Hull, I used to live in Hull, and they would say potato.
Potato. A curious potato.
Potato. Yeah, it's a great accent. It's a great town, great people.
And I love that he took a potato out of their ration allowance. Sent it to be displayed.
Sandra, this one looks like genitals. Get it sent in.
So that was my letter of the week. And then my poem comes from the Whitby Gazette.
Another fine paper.
Another great publication on the 28th of March, 1907. So this came from a section of the paper where there was the kind of children's section. So it was this guy called Uncle Ted who would write a kind of moralistic tale, and then they'd just have correspondence with the kids.
Right, okay.
So this was a letter actually as well written in that said, "Dear Uncle Ted, I now send a piece of poetry entitled A Letter from Catlin School." And it goes, "My dear Mama, it's getting time I sent you all a line. But first of all, I don't think much of this new school of mine. The food is poor as poor could be. For lunch, I had a sprat, a pretty dish, as one may say, to set before a cat. We never have a taste of cream, nor even for a treat. You wouldn't like the mousy pie they gave us here to eat. Our teachers pack us off to bed as soon as work is done, and so we never get a chance to have a bit of fun. There's one thing I must say of them, they teach us very well. I've learnt that 2 and 2 makes 5, and how to read and spell. Just notice how I write my name, I've got a lovely pen. Your loving niece, Grace Willis."
Men are dying as she's writing that.
She can't even be bothered to think of a last rhyme.
That's because her schooling is so poor.
2 and 2 make 5. I guess all the good teachers were off fighting.
Yeah, there was one. Yeah.
No excuse.
Any of the men between 18 and 40. Yeah, they were. I remember that's like the one I found last week where it was, or last time where it was their sister complaining that someone complaining her sister had won a poetry competition and now won't cook. I am a big fan of complaining through poetry. People should do
it's
more
really
of it.
It's really great. Yeah. It's my favorite medium for complaints.
I like dance.
I mean, yeah, interpretive dance is good too.
I like dance.
I like throat songs. They're pretty good.
Skywriting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and you know the signs that you can get for the back of the planes?
Yep. They actually have a lot. They have a lot of these.
All great.
They have a lot of those here. I was on Coney Island last weekend. This is running to date this podcast.
I saw one on Coney Island.
I was on Coney last weekend and to see Joey Chestnut, the competitive eater, eat 72 hot dogs in 10 minutes, which was grotesque.
Could you actually see? I imagine there were crowds, right?
You have no idea how big the crowd was. I stood completely stationary for like 2 hours waiting for it to start. Couldn't see anything. It was like...
That is a dedicated man.
Like 93 degree heat, no shade, I'm ginger. Couldn't get a drink or anything because I didn't want to lose my spot. So I was a curious potato, and I stayed, and it was a big waste of time. And then I went home. And then I went home.
It was all over in 10 minutes.
It took a long time to get to those 10 minutes.
Felt like a long 10 minutes too, I bet, watching a guy eat 6 dozen hot dogs.
Well, the thing is, you're watching like 15 people do it. And they're all like the regional winners, and there's some of them you're like, why did you bother coming? Like, you've done 18.
I love that there are stages to this.
Oh yeah, it's big business. It's big business. Anyway,
I think I can eat 18 in 10 minutes. That's not a lot.
It's a lot. I don't think this could be any more off topic. So I don't have anything else.
No, that's all from me.
All right, great. Well, thank you for tuning in, as always. I know I say it every week, but we'd really appreciate it if you get a chance to rate and view us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It helps with stuff. And we're going to be doing a thing called Two Pods a Day this week for the next little while. So keep an eye on Facebook and Twitter for that. It's quite an exciting thing to be involved with.
If you'd like to find us on Facebook or Twitter, we're at Paper Podcast on both. And playing us out are Al Jolson and Sophie Taylor with the International Rag, with thanks to the Free Music Archive.
Thank you, Free Music Archive. All of the resources we use for researching this episode will be available in the show notes. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks. Thanks a lot.
International.
Bye.
International.
The International Rag.